Is anyone here who happened to be present for our one-day seminar on the age of the Earth last year? You'll recognize our speaker this afternoon, Dr. Robert Newman, who graduated summa cum laude from Duke University with a B.S. in physics in 1963. He completed his Ph.D. in astrophysics at Cornell University. Dr. Newman also holds advanced theological degrees from Faith Theological Seminary and Biblical Theological Seminary, and is a Ph.D. candidate in the hermeneutics and biblical interpretation at Westminster Theological Seminary. Dr. Newman has published two books. One, co-authored with Dr. Peter Stoner, is the well-known Science Speak, now in its fourth edition. The other is co-authored with Herman Eggleman, and is entitled Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth. Numerous articles have appeared from the pen of Dr. Newman in such diverse periodicals as the Astrophysical Journal, Planetary and Space Science, Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, Westminster Theological Journal, and the Bulletin of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Newman is currently professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary, Hatfield, Pennsylvania. His address is entitled, A Critical Examination of Modern Cosmological Theory. My pleasure to give you Dr. Newman.
Does anyone not have a copy of my paper?
Send a few back down this way. Got one there. Anyone else? Okay, fine.
I will be reading this paper. I may have to stop and draw a picture on the board now and then, but I find that if I start rambling, we won't cover this material at all, but if I read it, we'll probably get it through. I also read it last night, and it looks a little on the terse side, maybe obscure. I'm sorry. I recommend that if you have some questions about anything, mark something in the margin, and we'll come back at the end. I hope we'll have a little time at the end for questions, and we'll try and attack those things. I'm going to start reading right the introduction rather than doing anything with the abstract. Cosmology is the study of the known parts of the universe in an attempt to describe the universe as a whole. It's the interpretation of that information presently reaching the Earth, with a view to reconstructing the entire history of the cosmos. With limitations such as these, we should not be surprised if cosmology is still more speculation than it is science, and that a great variety of cosmological models are proposed and defended. Like physicist Thomas Alfvén, we may wish to throw up our hands and dismiss cosmology as a waste of time. Yet the questions it deals with are too important to be safely ignored. The Bible warns us that the universe is created, and its creator will one day call us to account for every thought and action. However unlikely we may think it that the Bible is really a message from God, or that Christianity is true, the stakes are so high that if we are mistaken, it would be foolish for us to live like the universe is eternal without carefully examining whatever data may bear on the subject. Not only are questions of cosmology personally important for each of us, whether we realize it or not, but the scientific material available to answer these questions is more extensive today than ever before. With the development of ever larger optical telescopes, of radio telescopes since World War II, and most recently of artificial satellites, which make observations above our obscuring atmosphere, we now have enormous amounts of new data. Earth-bound work in physics has given us greatly increased understanding of the atom, nucleus and elementary particles, and of the gravitational, atomic, and nuclear forces at work in the universe. Therefore, we are responsible to press on with this sore travail that God has given us, to seek and search out by wisdom all things that are done unto heaven. In this paper, we shall sketch the scientific data relevant to cosmology, including such items as the nature of stars and their distances from us, galaxies and their redshift, Olber's paradox, cosmic distance scales, quasars, and the so-called 3-degree black body radiation. At convenient points in this discussion, we shall examine various cosmological models, some proposed by secular scientists, others by various Bible believers. In the end, we shall summarize our findings and propose a best model on the basis of present scientific knowledge. Nature of stars. Although astronomers are interested in planets, asteroids, and comets, well, cosmologists tend to confine their study to stars and galaxies, since these alone have been seen beyond our solar system. Let us first look at stars. What is a star? We have one nearby to study, the Sun, about 93 million miles or 8 light minutes away from us. The rest are at least 4 light years away, over a quarter million times further. Our Sun is a huge ball of gas, mostly hydrogen, held together by its own gravity. The temperature at its visible surface is several thousand degrees. As we calculate the temperature inward, it rises to about 10 million degrees at the center, so that the sun remains a gas all the way through, in spite of enormous density deep within. At the high central temperature, hydrogen undergoes a nuclear reaction, converting itself to helium, with the release of enormous amounts of energy. This energy, equivalent to the explosion of about 2,050,000,000 megaton hydrogen bombs per second, provides all our sunlight and keeps the sun from collapsing under the force of gravity. A mass of hydrogen equal to that of the sun should be able to keep burning by this reaction for about 10 billion years. That, in brief, is what the sun is like. Why do we believe the sun is a star, or, equivalently, that the star is the sun? There are several reasons. First of all, we can measure distances to about 1,000 of the nearest stars by a rather direct method of triangulation called parallax. This method is most easily illustrated by holding the finger up at arm's length and looking at it first with one eye and then with the other. Your finger appears to jump back and forth against its background. In astronomy, your finger corresponds to nearby stars. The background is a more distant star. Your eyes represent photos taken 6 months apart at opposite ends of the Earth's orbit, about 186 million miles apart within a couple inches. Measuring the amount of jump for each star, we find that the nearest stars are about 4 light years, 25 trillion miles away, and that for stars beyond about 100 light years, the jumps get too small to measure. Only about 1,000 of the billions of stars visible in our telescope show measurable jumps. What does this have to do with whether or not the stars are sun? Well, when we allow for the geometrical dimming of light due to distance, that is, it decreases with the square of the distance from the object, we find that the brightness of our sun is the same as that for stars the same color. Bluer stars can be brighter, red ones dimmer. We can even make a graph plotting star brightness opposite star color and show that most of these stars lie along a single line called the main sequence, and that the sun lies on this line too. The second argument, that stars are suns, comes by measuring their masses. We can do this whenever stars occur in pairs or groups, called binary or multiple stars, rotating around one another. We know the size of the orbit and the time it takes the stars to circle each other once. We can immediately compute the sum of their masses. For main sequence stars, those with the same color as our sun have the same mass. Bluer stars are heavier, the other ones are lighter. In these and many other ways, stars show themselves to be the same kind of object as our sun. Of course, stars differ considerably among themselves. Some are 100 times heavier than our sun, some 100 times lighter. Some have surface temperatures twice as cool, others 10 times hotter. Some expend their energy a million times faster, others a million times slower. However, there does appear to be a minimum size of stars. Observations agree with calculations that if an object has less than about 1% of the sun's mass, the central temperature will not be high enough to have a nuclear reaction, and the object will be a large planet like Jupiter rather than a star. At this point, we're ready to consider the proposal of radio preacher Harold Camping that the whole universe is really very small, only a few light years across. Camping argues that the parallax method described above merely shows us that the 1,000 nearest stars are closer than the background stars, but doesn't tell us how far away these background stars are. All distance measurements used on the background stars are unreliable, he says, being based upon false assumptions. Instead, these stars lie in a thin, spherical shell, only a short distance further away. So here we have the Earth here somewhere, and the thin spherical shell out here is maybe 5 or 6 light years, and the other stars, 1,000 stars, are closer in. That's his suggestion. This view is mistaken, as can be shown by several simple arguments based upon proportion, each of which is no less reliable than the parallax method. We can measure the motion of stars toward or away from us by a shift in the frequency of light coming from them, using a technique like that of police radar for catching spheres. For those pairs of binary stars that are far enough apart to appear as separate stars in a telescope, we can measure the angular size of their orbits and the speed at which the two stars move around each other. If they're only a few light years away, then the physical size of the orbits must be relatively small. Measure the angular size of the orbit, alpha, and if they're nearby, the orbit must be small. If they're far away, the orbit must be large, okay? With the they're only 2 light years away, then the physical size of the orbits must be relatively small, and the star should complete a round trip in just a few days. In fact, however, many such stars take years to make a circuit, and are therefore many hundreds of light years away. Second, according to Canton's view, the dimmer main sequence stars must appear to be dim because they're very small, rather than because they're very far away. Very dim stars as in a shell, and yet they're not much further away. They must appear, therefore, to be dim because they're small, rather than very far away. For the billions of very dim stars we observe in large telescopes, most of these would be so little that gravity could not hold them together. Third, these dimmer stars often form clusters. If we make a separate graph for each cluster, plotting star brightness opposite star color, a pattern is obtained, which is similar to that of 1,000 nearby stars. Each graph has a main sequence line. We assume the main sequence in each cluster has the same actual brightness for each color as does the main sequence in our nearby stars, and then these clusters are much farther away from us, some 100 light years, some 1,000, and some even further. The assumption made here is very reasonable, since computer calculations of star structure show that stars on the main sequence are merely those that get their energy by turning hydrogen into helium, in contrast to, for instance, red giant stars, which have used up their hydrogen and are now turning helium into carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Thus, the view that the universe is much larger than a few light years across is able to explain the energy source of stars and clusters by the same mechanism that explains the energy source of the sun and nearby stars. Such examples could be multiplied easily. They show us that the universe is really much bigger than the distances to the nearest star. As we look out in the universe, we see that most stars occur in clusters of hundreds of thousands of stars. These clusters, together with much gas and dust, form larger collections of stars we call galaxies. The galaxy in which we're located is called the Milky Way, since its more distant stars form a band across the sky to which the ancient Greeks gave its name. Our sun and nearby stars are also part of this galaxy, though they seem separate to us because we're among them. This is like the case in a large city, where nearby lights are distinct from the glow of the more distant parts of the city. Our galaxy is thought to have 100 to 200 billion stars, shaped like a spiral as viewed from above, or like a pair of marching band cymbals placed face to face. The whole galaxy is about 100,000 light years across, and we're about 2/3 of the way out from the center. Nearby are 2 small, irregularly shaped galaxies, which we call the Magellanic Clouds, since they were discovered for Europeans by Ferdinand Magellan, one of the voyagers around the world. They cannot be seen from places far north of the U.S. The nearest galaxy bigger than ours is the Andromeda Galaxy, containing some 200 to 300 billion stars, and located about 2 million light years away. Some galaxies are spiral, like the Milky Way and Andromeda. Some are elliptical, like Andromeda's small companion. Some are irregular, like the Magellanic Cloud. The smaller galaxies have hundreds of millions of stars. The larger galaxies have hundreds of billions. How do we know the distances to other galaxies? Obviously not by parallax, since this method only works for 1,000 or so nearest stars, all well within our own galaxy. The answer is that astronomers have developed a number of longer-range techniques for measuring distances. Each longer-range method is calibrated by using a technique that is good for shorter distances and which overlaps the range of the other. Techniques good over the same range are also checked one against another. What are these distance measuring techniques? Most of them depend on some method of calculating the actual or absolute brightness of a star cluster, a galaxy. Then the apparent brightness of the object is observed. Since apparent brightness decreases with the square of the distance from the object, from object to observer, the distance to the object can then be calculated. We've already looked at one method for determining absolute brightness. Main sequence stars of the same color are the same brightness. Certain types of variable stars also have a definite average brightness. Average brightness means they're variable. They go up the bright, down, up the bright, etc. So if you think average brightness, a definite average brightness, which is related to the rate at which they fluctuate. Main sequence stars and variable stars are used to measure distances within our galaxy and to several nearby galaxies out to a few million light years. In nearby galaxies, we notice that the brightest stars in the galaxy and the brightest globular cluster tend to have a definite brightness by which distances can be measured out to 100 million light years. Beyond this distance, measurements are less certain, so it appears that the brightest galaxies and large galaxy clusters have a similar brightness. This gives very rough distance measurements as the most distant known galaxies over a billion light years away. 2 secular scientists, Perry Moon and Dominic Spencer, have proposed that certain phenomena of binary stars, usually explained by Einstein's theory of relativity, can be explained without relativity if you assume that light travels in circles of radius 5 light years instead of in straight lines. In such a cosmology, the universe may be arbitrarily large in actuality, but an observer could never see objects more than 10 light years away, since light from more distant sources would curve back on itself before reaching it. Yet, though there exist only a dozen or so stars within 10 light years of us, these might be supposed to appear as billions of stars, as we see their light on its first, second, third, or even millionth circuit around the heavens. This suggestion seems to have attracted little interest in secular circles, but a number of young Earth creationists have spoken favorably of it. These creationists see such a model as a possible explanation of how light from apparently distant objects could reach us in just a few years, thereby avoiding the problem of having God create light already on its way to us for objects over 10,000 light years away. Unfortunately, the cosmology of Moon and Spencer will not solve this problem, and it's hardly likely to be the actual state of affairs in any case. First place, the model does not solve the problem of light travel time, even though the apparently brightest stars might be those which we're seeing directly, and the dimmer ones be light from the same stars which have made many trips around the universe. This dimmer light must still have traveled a long way and taken a long time to do it. Only the light from the first direct image of the stars would reach us in less than 15 years. The second image light would have to take an additional circuit, arriving about 30 years later, the circumference of the circle with diameter 10 light years. Light, which by dimness and other distance measuring techniques appears to come from more than 10,000 light years away, would actually have made several hundred circuits and taken over 10,000 years to do so. It therefore does not appear that the optically small universe of Moon and Spencer is any help for young Earth creationists. Nor is the model at all likely to be true. Since the radius of curvature for light rays in this model is 5 light years, we would see nothing that is actually further away than 10 light years. This would mean that our sky has only a handful of real stars, and all the rest of the star images are multiple reflections of these. This would be similar to looking into one of those wraparound mirrors sometimes found in clothing stores or amusement parks, which we see multiple images of ourselves. It should only take a few minutes of study of astronomical photographs to convince us that we are not merely looking at multiple reflections. The images of globular clusters and galaxies, for instance, are too coherent with centers, rotational motion, and such to be in the multiple images of only a dozen stars. Then, too, there are far more than a dozen different star colors, sizes, and densities, which we observe. Since the 1920s, we have known that except for a few galaxies in our local group, the light coming to us from all the galaxies is redshifted. This means that the dark lines in the spectrum of each galaxy caused by the various chemical elements in the cooler outer atmosphere of each star absorbing the light passing through are located at longer wavelengths corresponding to redder light than they are for absorption by the same element in the laboratory on Earth. Not only is the light redshifted, but the amount of shift is larger for more distant galaxies, increasing in approximately linear way with distance. There are only three known mechanisms that redden light. One, scattering by dust and gas. Two, gravity reddening. And three, motion reddening. The first of these causes the sun to look red near sunset once light passes through many more miles of atmosphere to reach us than it does when overhead. For galaxies, though, this reddening would be due to gas and dust in outer space between us and the galaxy. This reddening would increase with distance like the redshift does, but it wouldn't shift the spectral line. Therefore, this cannot be the proper explanation. Gravity reddening is due to the energy lost by light as it fights its way out of a strong gravitational field. It does shift the spectral line towards the red, but there's no reason why it should produce more reddening for more distant galaxies. This explanation, too, is inadequate to explain the lack of redshift. Motion reddening is a shift in light frequency due to the movement of light source and observer away from one another. More commonly known as Doppler shift, it also allows for blue shifts from source and observer approaching one another. Most of us have observed the Doppler shift of sound, a sound wave, in noticing the change in pitch of the train whistle, auto horn, or a siren when the vehicle passes us. The tone is higher pitched as the vehicle approaches and suddenly drops as it passes and begins to move away. The light wave, it is color, not pitch, which we observe, and the color seems bluer for approaching objects and redder for receding ones. The effect is not noticeable at ordinary speeds without special equipment, and we do not commonly see objects traveling at appreciable fraction of the speed of light. This explanation will fit the observed galactic redshift if it is assumed that all galaxies except a few in our local group are moving away from us. This assumption, known as the expansion of the universe, is generally accepted by cosmologists today. Some cosmologists, however, prefer to postulate some unknown mechanism to produce the galactic redshift rather than accept the strange idea that all the galaxies are moving apart. Cosmologies which deny an expanding universe are called static universes, This is not to be confused with a steady state universe we'll discuss later. The various mechanisms proposed for Redding are usually called tired light theory. French physicist Jean-Pierre Vieille, for instance, proposes that an otherwise unknown lightweight elementary particle exists, which scatters light in such a way as to redshift the spectral line to force the distance of light travel. This cosmology cannot be ruled out on the present knowledge as far as I know. However, scientists are reluctant to postulate unknown forces or particles without some more definite evidence. Such a large static universe, created at a finite time in the past, could fit the observed data. If, however, one proposes a static universe which is uncreated, and therefore eternal, several other problems arise. Since gravity is only an attractive force, such a universe would not remain static unless another unknown force is postulated to balance gravity, that is, it starts to collapse. This is what Einstein did by adding his cosmological constant to his equation. He was not willing to have a universe with a beginning. In the second place, stars have a fixed amount of hydrogen fuel and a substantial rate at which they burn the fuel. Therefore, no star burns forever. Since stars are still burning today, proponents of an eternal static universe must postulate some unknown mechanism to recycle fuel. Such a process would presumably use considerable energy itself or violate the principle of entropy by which energy tends to disperse itself. Eternal static universes of infinite size are also troubled by Olber's paradox. Named for a 19th century astronomer, this paradox arises from the obvious fact that the sky is dark at night. An eternal universe filled with stars should have a bright sky. Let me explain. The brightness of a light diminishes as the square of our distance from its source. If we divide up the universe into spherical shells of equal thickness centered on ourselves, or imaginary division, each shell increases in volume as the square of the distance from us, exactly canceling the diminishing of the light. Therefore, each shell having the same density of stars will give us the same amount of light no matter how far away it is. For an infinite universe, the sky should be infinitely bright, or allowing stars to block the light from stars behind them, as bright as the surface of an average star. Obviously, this is not the case. The paradox can only be avoided if one of the following is true. One, the universe is finite in size, so there is no light from shells beyond a certain distance. Two, the universe is finite in age, so that no light has yet reached us from shells beyond a certain distance. Three, the universe is expanding in such a way that the shells beyond a certain distance are traveling away from us faster than the speed of light, and so light will never reach us from them. Four, the universe is hierarchical, so that the more distant shells have less and less stars in such a way that the total sky appears dark instead of daytime. Only the last of these four alternatives would give an infinitely large and infinitely old static universe. And this is such a peculiar special case that few would be willing to defend it. Since it still fails the problem of gravity, fuel, the trouble of a static cosmology, we conclude that a static universe, eternal or not, really doesn't fit the known scientific data without very specialized assumptions about the existence of unknown law. Many young Earth creationists believe that our universe is very large, whether static or expanding, but very young, no more than about 10,000 years old. Since most of the objects visible in our larger telescopes give every indication of being more than 10,000 light years away, this distance is still inside our galaxy, many proponents of this view claim that the light from these distant objects was created on its way and never actually left the objects with the light that was in. Such a view is dependent on the grounds that God created objects with apparent age, that Adam looked full-grown, say 25 years old, only a moment after he was created, that newly created trees had growth rings in them, that the wine Jesus created in Cana tastes like it's been grown on vines and aged. There is certainly some merit to the idea of a fictitious apparent age or objects brought into existence suddenly. However, not being present, we can only speculate on whether or not such an apparent age would be indistinguishable from actual age. Would newly created trees really have growth rings? Would Adam have a navel ring, even though he was never born? Would he have toughened or baby soft skin? We don't know. But this view, when applied to cosmology, must take an additional and substantial step from apparent age to fictitious history, using history in a broad sense. Let me explain. When we look out into space with a telescope, we are actually looking back into the past because light takes time to travel. Looking at the sun, we see events that happened there about 8 minutes ago, since we are about 8 light minutes away. When we observe the star Alpha Centauri about 4 light years away, we see what was happening there 4 years ago. Similarly, for more distant stars, we see the radiation, flare, variation, rotation, positioning, and so on. That is, the events occurring on them when light left these stars, whether 10, 100, or 1,000 years ago. But according to the theory of a young created light universe, when we reach, say, a distance of 10,000 light years, we suddenly shift from real history to fictitious history without any seam or joint, that is, some sort of flash or discontinuity, to indicate that anything unusual happened. Thus, the phenomena we see in the Andromeda Galaxy, for example, represent merely the galactic rotation, stellar position, stellar explosions, expanding H2 regions, and so forth, that would have happened had the galaxy existed 2 million years ago. Yet these events didn't actually happen, because none of these things existed. Such a view bristles with both scientific and theological problems, far more severe, it seems to me, than the suggestion that the Bible does not narrate a unique creation. Another way to have a large, young universe which is less troublesome theologically is to assume that the speed of light is very high or infinite at creation, so that light from all the distant reaches of the universe reached the Earth immediately or soon after creation. Thereafter, the speed of light decreased with its present value. The proposal was entertained in some favor by Paul Seidel. Unless the speed of light dropped immediately after creation of its present value, it should be higher as we look back in the past. Now, several important constants occurring in spectroscopy, the study of the spectrum of stars, involve the speed of light. For instance, the fine structure constant, the proton-magneton-related hyperfine structure. If this proposal is valid, we might be able to test it by observing the fine and hyperfine structure in the spectra of stars in our stellar gas. This would be difficult at optical wavelength because the details get lost in the motions of the gas. But at radio wavelength, the radiation is often due to transition between fine or hyperfine energy levels. Thus, the so-called 21-centimeter spectral line of hydrogen involves a hyperfine transition, yet it gives no evidence for a change in the speed of light as far out as we can detect it, several million light years so far. At present, the idea that the speed of light has changed radically in the past 10,000 years seems to be fraught with serious scientific problems. Let us continue with our discussion of cosmological data. The development of radio telescopes, powerful radio receivers with giant antennas, after World War II, led in 1964 to the discovery by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson that at radio wavelengths, the sky is not black, but gray. This radiation comes to us uniformly from all directions and is thus called isotropic. It does not vary in intensity daily or seasonally. Therefore, it must not originate in our solar system, galaxy, or even galaxy cluster, as these sources would all give such a time variation because of our off-center location in each of these. The spectrum of this radiation has been measured over a wide range of wavelengths, from just under a meter to well under a millimeter, more than 500 times the range of our visible spectrum. Throughout this range, the spectrum conforms well to that of a so-called black body, an object that perfectly absorbs all radiation falling on it and re-emits it in a spectrum that depends on the body's temperature only, a black body at a temperature of around 3 degrees above absolute zero. This radiation is therefore commonly known as the 3-degree black body radiation. The isotropy and spectrum of this radiation fit very nicely into the scheme of the Big Bang cosmology to be discussed later. In these views, the radiation is seen as a remnant of radiation from the universe as a whole at the time of the Big Bang, which has subsequently cooled down due to the expansion of the universe. Cosmologist George Gemow predicted such radiation on the basis of the Big Bang cosmology about 20 years before it was actually discovered. Quasar. Early in the 1960s, Martin Schmidt and other radio astronomers discovered a new class of astronomical objects which they called quasi-stellar radio objects, or quasars for short. The longer name tells us a bit about them. The objects look like stars in optical telescopes, and they probably would never have been noticed had it not been for their unusual brightness at radio wavelengths that are called radio sources. But it's the spectrum of quasars that reveals their significance for cosmology. Quasars have redshifts, which are greater than those in the most distant known galaxies. If these redshifts are due to the expansion of the universe, and if the expansion is linear with distance, then the furthest known quasars are about 10 billion light years away. Furthermore, if quasars are as far away as the redshifts indicate, then they are the most powerful objects in the sky, somewhat straining our imagination to dream up energy sources for them. Present proposals include matter annihilation, stellar collisions, or enormous black holes to provide their energy. Of course, it's possible that quasars are not really so far away, but that their redshifts have another explanation. Astronomer Halton Arp has suggested that the quasars are fragments blown off by exploding galaxies. But so far, he has been unable to locate any blue-shifted quasars to represent fragments blown in our direction. This is a serious problem for his view. Moreover, a number of quasars show secondary smaller redshifts in the spectra, suggesting that some of their light has been absorbed by gas clouds between us and them. Since these smaller redshifts are still quite large, it looks like the quasars are really at the enormous distances that their redshifts indicate. Steady-state universe. Shortly after the end of World War II, the English cosmologist Herman Bondy, Common Gold, and Fred Hoyle proposed what has come to be known as the steady-state cosmology. Accepting the evidence we have sketched above for a finite lifetime for stars, for a universe which is expanding, they yet claimed that the universe was infinitely large and had always existed. Instead of being static, like the model mentioned above, or thinning out, like the steady state, like the Big Bang cosmology we will mention below, this universe was in a dynamic steady state in which the density of matter is kept constant, while the new matter is moving away, by the expedient of adding new matter as the old matter moves away. This new matter is continually being added by creation, not the supernatural act of God, but the natural workings of an impersonal force. The new matter also serves to fuel new stars, which are constant, which are continually forming. And thus, the stars we now see are only some billions of years old, but that at any time in the past, no matter how far back, there have always been stars burning. The debris from burnout stars does not clog up the cosmos because the universal expansion carries it away. Bondy, Gold, and Boyle claimed their cosmology was philosophically more satisfying than cosmology with some sort of beginning, such as the Big Bang cosmology, because their theory satisfies a perfect cosmological principle. This principle states that the universe, viewed on a sufficiently large scale, looks the same at all times, in all places, and in all directions. Competing cosmologies only satisfy the cosmological principle, that the universe looks the same in all places and all directions, but changes with time. In spite of the fact that the steady-state theory postulated the violation of virtually every conservation law in physics, but all on a scale too small to detect locally, it enjoyed a considerable vogue until about 1965, when new observations began to press it severely. The most important of these observations were, one, the 3-degree black body radiation described above, which was predicted by Big Bang cosmology, but unexpected by the black steady-state theory. Two, fact that there are more quasars per unit volume at great distances, that is, far back in the past, than nearby, that is, recently, violating the perfect cosmological principle, suggesting the universe is more crowded far back in time than it is now. Since 1965, Hoyle has retreated to a modification of the steady-state theory, which is beyond the empirical test. We are in an expanding part of the universe that is steady-state, and we'll never be able to observe other parts of the universe in black. Varieties of the Big Bang universe. Since the 60s, the Big Bang cosmology has held the field as best fitting the available data. Yet the Big Bang theory is actually a group of several alternative theories. One, the oscillating cosmology. Two, the signal bounce Big Bang. And three, the no bounce Big Bang. All these agree that the universe is presently expanding from an event which occurred 10 to 20 billion years ago, the Big Bang. At that time, the universe began to expand from a highly compressed state at very great temperature, possibly both temperature and density were infinite. Since then, the universe has been expanding and cooling. The quasars are some sort of object, perhaps a special type of galaxy, that existed early in the history of expansion. The black body radiation comes from even earlier, a remnant of a fireball at the time radiation and matter separated and the universe became relatively transparent. The three varieties of Big Bang cosmology differ on what the Big Bang was and what happened before it. The no-bounds Big Bang theory was proposed first in the 20s by Georges Lemaître, a Belgian Roman Catholic astronomer who apparently envisioned the Big Bang as a creation event. Georges Lemaître later removed creation by suggesting that the Big Bang was rather a Big Bounce. His one-bounce Big Bang theory proposed that the universe was a thin hydrogen gas from eternity past, which gradually pulled itself together by gravity and bounced. It's been expanding ever since, and will continue to do so forever. The theory is later modified in the oscillating cosmology, which sees the universe as ultimately expanding and contracting, with a big bang, big bounce, every 100 billion years or so. It is this last form of the theory which is most popular today, both among cosmologists and with the general public, where Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov have been especially active in promoting it. Let us examine the variety in reverse order. Since the oscillating cosmology sees the universe as alternately expanding and contracting forever, its problem, naturally enough, involves one, making the expanding universe stop expanding and begin contracting, two, making the contracting universe stop contracting and begin expanding, and three, doing both forever. As the oscillating cosmology shares problem two, stopping a contracting universe from contracting and making it start expanding, with the now one-balanced cosmology, let's look at the other problem first. We'll look, first of all, at doing both forever. Forever is a long time. If there's any process in the universe as a whole which causes it to lose energy at a non-vanishing rate, the oscillating universe would long ago have ceased to oscillate. So, for this model to work, the universe cannot be a finite amount of matter in an open and infinite space. Otherwise, the radiation will be lost on every oscillation. If, then, we assume the universe is a finite amount of matter in a closed three-dimensional space, which expands and contracts in a four-dimensional space, we must also assume that none of the energy of expansion leaks away into the four-dimensional space. This is a very unlikely assumption, since we have no examples of energy confined to one-dimensional or two-dimensional spaces which do not leak into three dimensions. Can the universe, then, have an infinite amount of matter? Perhaps. But getting an infinite amount of matter, which is spread over an infinite volume of space, to coordinate its activity so as to expand and contract in unison, seems to be a tall order for natural law to accomplish. And if we postulate a coordinator, we might as well have a creator. So much for problem three. Problem one, getting a expanding universe to stop expanding and start contracting, is easily solved theoretically. All we need is sufficient density of matter for its self-gravity eventually to overcome the expansion and turn it into a contraction. This is like throwing a ball up in the air and waiting until gravity pulls it back to Earth. On Earth, however, we have plenty of gravity and not much velocity for a hand-thrown ball, so naturally the ball soon stops rising and begins to fall. If, however, we increase the velocity sufficiently by, say, shooting it up in a rocket at more than 7 miles a second, it won't come back. Alternatively, if we throw the ball up from the surface of a small enough planet, say at 70 miles an hour from an asteroid less than 20 miles in diameter, the gravity won't be strong enough even to stop the ball moving that slow. What is the case for our universe? Is the matter density high enough to stop its expansion eventually, or not? At present, the answer appears to be that the expansion will not stop. We have only been able to locate something like 1 to 10% of the density needed to stop the expansion. Astronomers have counted the visible stars, the total matter in and around the galaxy, and the invisible hydrogen gas between galaxies. About the only candidates left are black holes between galaxies, not black holes within galaxies, and the possibility that certain elementary particles called neutrinos are not actually massless as previously thought. For the oscillating cosmology, problem one, therefore, may be soluble, though it looks bad at its present. Problem three seems insoluble without making very special and unlikely assumptions. As Jastrow suggests, that's Robert Jastrow of Dartmouth, Columbia, and the Goddard Space Flight Center, the favor that the oscillating cosmology presently enjoys is probably more the result of a religious motivation, a desire to eliminate creation, than to any evidential merit of the theory. Problem to the one-balanced cosmology. Gamow's one-balanced cosmology postulates that the universe has always existed. From eternity past to about 10 to 20 billion years ago, it was rather dull, a mass of hydrogen gas gradually pulling itself together by means of gravity. At the Big Bang, it bounced, and since then it's been expanding, forming galaxies, stars, planets, life, and so forth, all of which will one day die, though the universe will continue to expand forever as a collection of dark and lifeless cinders. This theory has not been nearly so popular as the oscillating model, though perhaps it is reflected in T.S. Eliot's poem about the world ending not with a bang, but a whimper. The one-bounce theory avoids the oscillating cosmology problem three with energy loss, as no eternally repeating cycle is envisioned. It does have a problem of its own with eternity. It also avoids problem one, as the one-bounce universe never stops expanding once it starts. It does share problem two, stopping a contraction and starting expansion, with the oscillating cosmology, so we must examine this also. First, let us look at the one-bound theory problem with eternity. Gamal postulates that for an infinite period of time, the universe is contracting towards the Big Bang. This involves a contraction rate that is at zero at eternity's past and gradually increases in just such a way as to take an infinite time to accomplish a finite action. This is easily arranged mathematically by means of an asymptotic function, but it is questionable whether it could ever be arranged physically without a supernatural arranger. The slightest non-uniformity in the mass distribution will produce local contraction at a substantial rate instead. On the problem two, can a contracting universe bounce so as to begin expanding? More seriously, can a universe which must contract to such high densities and temperatures as will produce the Big Bang fireball subsequently bounce, stop contracting? The cosmological equations of Einstein and Friedman have a mathematical singularity at the hoped-for bounce point, indicating that the temperature and density would go to infinity. Is this over-idealized? Attempts to avoid this problem by introducing irregularity do not appear to work. This agrees with our present knowledge of physical forces, where at very high density, gravity, which is only attractive, overcomes the repulsive elements in the nuclear and electromagnetic forces and pulls everything into a black hole from which there is no escape. Asimov would like to think that our whole universe is a black hole, but he has still not succeeded in explaining why its matter should bounce when highly compressed. Of course, one can postulate some unknown force that saves the theory just in the nick of time by introducing a repulsion sufficient to overcome gravity, but which comes into play only at densities of temperature high enough to produce the Big Bang fireball. Jastrow, however, argues that even this is insufficient. Such a repulsive force, says Jastrow, will have an equivalent potential energy E, and its energy by Einstein's equivalent formula E equals mc squared will function like a mass m. This mass, when added to the mass already present, will strengthen the gravitational force enough to overcome the repulsive force, so that the hole will still collapse into a black hole. Thus, Big Bang cosmology exploring a bounce seem to be fatally flawed unless one postulates a very special repulsive force that does not obey Einstein's mass energy equivalent principle. Lemaître is no bounce cosmology. The original form of the Big Bang theory avoids the problems discussed above. By having creation at the Big Bang, one avoids the problem of contraction and bounce. The theory has enough flexibility to fit an ever-expanding universe or one which eventually contracts. Eternal activity is transferred outside the universe to God the Creator rather than remaining in the physical laws and causing the problems faced by the various non-supernatural cosmologies we have discussed. Just this January, J. Richard Gott at Princeton University proposed a radically new cosmology which he hopes will replace the Big Bang model of things. As yet, it's too early to tell whether his hope will be realized. Gott agrees that our universe began at the Big Bang without a previous contraction, but he suggests that our universe is really only an expanding bubble in an infinitely old and large consider universe. This larger outside universe is possibly to contain nothing but radiation at extremely high temperature, 5 times 10 to the 31st degrees Kelvin, and high pressure, 3 times 10 to the 93 grams per cubic centimeter. The matter in our universe, God says, condensed out from radiation entering the bubble at its beginning. The bubble will continue to expand forever. The high temperature and pressure of the Big Bang is a reflection of the conditions in the outside universe. The isotropy of our universe and the Big Bang is also a reflection of the isotropy of radiation in the distributed universe. The mathematics and geometry of this proposal are sufficiently complex to make physical intuitions and quick critiques difficult. For instance, it would seem to me that the enormous external radiation pressure would inhibit expansion of the bubble, but this may be solved by having the boundaries of the bubble be relativistic horizons. Nevertheless, let us note that to avoid a creator, this cosmology must postulate the existence of an infinite and external and eternal exterior force to explain our visible universe. The big difference between this model and creation is the impersonal nature of its creator, the distributed universe. Yet it is just this impersonality which raises the question whether an isotropic and energetic radiation field can really explain the organized complexity that we know exists in our actual universe. Conclusions. We have now completed our rather sketchy survey of the data and theories of modern cosmology. What can we say in conclusion? First of all, it's fair to say that we still know too little observationally and theoretically to be able to specify a single scientific model for the nature of the universe. Secondly, yet the universe is certainly large. There is little reason to deny that some of the objects are more than a billion light years away from us, or even more than 10 billion light years if the quasar redshifts are cosmological. Third, the universe gives every appearance of being old but a finite age, probably in the range of 10 to 20 billion years. Alternative proposals, that the universe is infinitely old, or only a few thousand years old, are really controlled by other considerations in scientific data, and they interpret the data to fit. Fourth, the universe is most naturally understood to be created. The no-balance Big Bang of Lemaître gives the best fit among theories that have been tested for some time. Even the new Gott-de-Sitter cosmology postulates an unobservable, infinite, eternal power, though natural and non-personal, beyond our universe to explain its basic heat. But shouldn't scientists prefer a natural and non-personal cause for the universe over a supernatural and personal one? Isn't the former the simpler hypothesis? Two remarks are in order here. The first relating to the definition of science. The second is a matter of simplest hypothesis. What is science? Is it a game to see if we can explain everything without recourse to the supernatural? Or is it an attempt to find out how things really are? If the former, then of course we prefer a natural or non-personal cause, but science is then somewhat trivialized. If it's the latter, find out how things really are, then we prefer the hypothesis that has the best evidence and the best ability to explain. What does it mean to choose the simplest hypothesis? Surely not choose one so simple that doesn't fit the data. And the data of cosmology cannot finally exclude the fact that the universe we actually inhabit contains life and men and the Bible. The evidence of extremely complex design found in living things, especially in the mind of man, and the evidence of the moral sphere in man argue that this infinite eternal power behind the universe is more like a mind than it is like a force. Though well outside the scope of this paper, there is quite adequate evidence that this mind is the God of the Bible. How do our conclusions square with the Bible? Like the cosmological evidence, the Bible pictures the universe as immeasurably large. Jeremiah 31:37, Jeremiah 33:22, Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, but apparently finite. Psalm 147:4. It is also described as created by the infinite personal God of the Bible, here and there throughout Scripture. The major problem regards the age of the universe. The Bible has traditionally been understood to teach a recent creation, and this is the main reason for the strength of young Earth creationist movement in evangelical circles today. Yet it is imperative that we realize that the Bible itself nowhere indicates that the Earth is young, that the days of Genesis 1 are literal and consecutive, or that the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11 should be added up to give a complete chronology. I have sought to deal with these matters elsewhere in my book, Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, so I will refer readers there for a more detailed explanation. As the Earth and universe, an Earth and universe some billions of years old, is not taught explicitly in the Bible, but it is not in disagreement with a fair and reasonable interpretation of the biblical creation account. Okay, I will try to entertain some questions. I won't guarantee anything. Yes, sir. How wide is our galaxy in light years? It usually gets to be about 100,000 light years across the longest direction. Okay? Yes, sir. I think it's fair to say that there is no model that has no problems. I'm inclined to think that Lemaître's no balance Big Bang theory, okay, suitably modified to allow for things to be discovered since he died in the late 30s. I think, I'm not sure of his death, but since proposed in the late 30s, is that it gives a better fit for the data than the alternatives I've seen. But I think it's fair to say that there are problems with all of the models that we suggested, and I did suggest that the data we have does not force us to a single model at the present time. Yes, ma'am. But, oh, sorry, just wrapping. Back here in the back.
Some agree that there's a constellation of galaxies. It's moving towards Virgo, right?
It's thought that the galaxy may be moving towards Virgo cluster. Okay, yes. There's some complications there regarding what kind of geometry you're going to devise for the universe, okay, as a model. If you devise a model that the universe is a three-dimensional bubble expanding in a four-dimensional space, I don't know how to explain this to you in a too visualizable way, then each point in our space is kind of like the surface of a two-dimensional bubble expanding in a three-dimensional space, and the center is nowhere in the space, but that the whole space, you know, you take the bubble backwards at the time it forms on the top of the bubble pipe, or that flood bubble, okay? When the bubble is just starting to form, it's all at the center, and as it gets bigger, the center is within it, and everything is equal distance from the center moving away, okay? So it's possible that the geometry of our cosmos is like that, and therefore the center is not within our three-dimensional space. It's in the four-dimensional space at some interior point. Just as in a bubble is a two-dimensional figure curved back on itself, surface of bubble, okay? The center of that two-dimensional surface is not on the surface. It's elsewhere. It's actually three-dimensional space, okay? That is a possibility. That is probably the favored geometry of our cosmos, which then gives you no center within your own universe, okay? The other alternative would be to imagine a pure three-dimensional universe, and there was some point in the universe from which everything is blasting away. It would still be very difficult to find it if the movement away from it is linear with distance, because to each observer, it looks like he is in the center and everything is going away from him. But he might still not be in the center, and unless you could find edge and then be able to figure out what the curvature of the edge is and track that back, then you could begin to find out something about the center. So that's really a rather complicated question, and it shows us something of the fact that we haven't got it all together in cosmology yet, okay? Let's see, I think there was a question over here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the book of Revelation just said that at some time in the future, the star is going to fall on Earth. What sort of cosmology would explain that?
I think probably the easiest way to explain that, we're going to have to wait and see. Okay, there are many, many features about the book of Revelation that there are people arguing. Is this figurative or is this literal? And the Bible does use figures of speech. And the Bible, of course, speaks literally most of the time. Most of those, we're going to have to wait and see. Now, in that particular case, I'll give you what I think is the case. Since people survive it, okay, there are people around after these stars have fallen. I think what we see there is the use of star in the ancient Greek that is a little different than it is in technical modern English. In technical modern English, stars are very large masses of gas and such, and if any one of them fell on the Earth, that'd be the end of the Earth. Okay? But in ancient Greek, star is a term for something bright that's in the sky, and comets and meteors are included as well as stars. Now, meteors falling on Earth will do a lot of damage, but if you don't have to be where they are, it might not kill you. I'm inclined to think that the falling of the stars in Revelation, which seem to precede a lot of other events that continue to go on the Earth, are probably meteor falls of some variety, though they might be something else. But the term star, as used in ancient Greek, and as used in English perhaps only 200 or 300 years ago, can be something else. Shooting stars, for instance. It's still a common term left over from a century or so ago for meteors. I think that's what's going on there in Revelation. Back in the back.
But no one has looked at substitution of language as either a cosmogonical replacement of cosmological.
Only because cosmogonical is not being used much anymore. And I don't want to know the readers any more than that, right?
It's just a matter of acting.
To origin, okay. Yeah. Well, notice we're talking also about the nature of it as well. Yeah. Cosmology is a broad term for nature, including origin, and cosmogony is a narrow term for origin, but excluding nature, except as relates to it. You're certainly right.
On page 14, where this has to do with your idea of the personal force, how do you define natural?
That's not easy. You often get into problems with that variety. I think a physical scientist, which is my background, tends to think of natural as phenomena that appear to be non-personal, probably, although most particularly non-theistic scientists are inclined to think that even personal activities are finally explainable by non-personal natural laws. I think that's actually impossible myself, but I can't prove that. But okay, so natural, I think it's based on the idea that there is a law structure in the universe, and things operating according to that law structure are normally called natural, whereas supernatural, for instance, means some kind of a personal intervention into that law structure.
So, would it then be reasonable to say that when these people refer to some natural but impersonal, they really mean unnatural and impersonal?
Well, I don't think they'd want to say unnatural. They would.
I
think they would admit that they haven't discovered the law yet, but they're kind of hoping there's a law out there that it would work on. Okay. Yeah. Yes. If you define unnatural law as undiscovered natural law, that's what they're looking for, or postulated natural law. Yes. You certainly say something like that. Yes, sir. Here. My understanding of the matter, I developed this at some length in my book Genesis 1, The Origin of the Earth, which does not deal with most of the subjects here in this paper, but deals with the origin of the solar system and the planet Earth and such. My suggestion there is that the origin of life is related to God putting together various things as he is building the universe. I think the remark, "let there be light" in Genesis 1, has to do with the beginning of the lighting, of the glowing of the sun. Oh, life, excuse me, I missed that. Let me rehear the question with life in it now. Mm-hmm. Okay, I would disagree with that myself. I'll show, and if you'd like to look at my book, see how I handle that. Okay, I would have "let there be light" is the creation of the sun as it begins to glow. Okay, it reaches a glowing point at that point. I would say regarding the creation of life that, as best I can tell from my studies, real supernatural interventions are necessary to make life out of non-life. It does not look to me like a series of processes according to natural law are at all likely to produce that, and the unlikelihood is so high that even persons who don't have much inclination toward the creator, such as Fred Hoyle and Chandra with Promising, have begun to move over in that particular direction. But yes, surely. Now, of course, I believe that God, who is life, existed before the universe. Okay. And I think there's reason to believe from a passage in Hebrews that that universe which the unseen beings inhabit is not our universe, and we don't have a description of its creation. So I think of a passage in Hebrews that speaks of the heavenly tabernacle as not being of this creation. Okay, that's certainly obscure, but I'm inclined that direction. Further questions? Yes, sir, here.
You mentioned the Bible teaches that creation.
One. Yes, I think it does for certain things. I think it's clear that it does not teach ex nihilo creation for everything it's created, though the matter of it, the matter energy of it, was created somewhere back. In other words, the description of the creation of man's body explicitly mentions using something existing. And the creation of the plants and animals at least say, "let the waters bring forth, let the land bring forth," which could be understood as using the waters and land in some way in this matter. I believe that the origin universe itself must in some sense be ex nihilo, and it may well be that the spiritual nature of man is ex nihilo, but we don't know what the spiritual nature of man is.
So would you create the ex nihilo of man with the Big Bang at that very moment?
Yes, I think I would. Now, that gets a little tricky on the flash of the isotropic radiation is not equated with the Big Bang itself by cosmologists, but with the clearing of the universe so that light is now transparent. So the Big Bang is actually before the flash. But yes, I would do that.
Maybe the matter of the sun could have come into existence.
Then, I think, or at least the matter energy, which will form the sun. There's the whole question of what's going on through that period, which I don't understand a great deal, even of the level of the theories that are being postulated. Yes, yes sir, here.
The combination,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Einstein's fundamental laws of the
square. Right.
And he's shown, you know, experimentally, the A-bomb, and with future accelerator effects, that one, matter became insecure, and energy came back to matter.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering if, with stars burning and all these different particles that they're discovering, that energy itself might be just some sort of a ultra-small, kind of a particle-like thing.
Yeah.
And maybe that as light travels through the universe, like the so-called red ship might be interacting.
Well, there are certainly people who would agree that there's some sense in which energy is particulate also, at least light energy is self-occurring photons and such. Admittedly, that's not been solved totally. We really haven't found gravitons and things, so there are a number of postulated particles that have never been discovered. Attempts to make a redshift out of just a travel of light usually have to require that there's something to shift it. And this one by Vigier, mentioned in my paper here, is an attempt to postulate another small particle that scatters light in such a way as to get a shift, which is possible, as I said, but we haven't found a particle. So the major problem against that in favor then of an expanding universe is an expanding universe uses a known physical law, and the other one has to postulate a special type of unknown physical law which hasn't been verified. Now, if it were verified, then you'd have a new ballgame, and that does happen occasionally in science, that something is verified which has been postulated before, and it's not highly regarded until a verification comes along. Further questions here? Yes, sir?
Why don't you have somebody else find any quasars, nearby? Why are they always way out beyond?
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. Of course, one thing is, they are not very common. Okay, in other words, the average density of quasars, even way out there, is thin enough that none of them would necessarily be close by if we were out there by them, okay? I mean, if we were out there in that distance, we still wouldn't necessarily be near one. But there's no question that at more distant observations today, there seem to be a lot more of them per unit volume than there are close by per unit volume. And that, in fact, is exactly the reason why a Big Bang-type cosmology, in which things were much, much more compressed as far back in time, are much less compressed now. Now, there's an additional possibility, and that is that quasars may be related to some kind of phenomena early in the history of the universe, and they're all used up by now. So nearby you don't see them because they're gone. They've worn out, so to speak, and they're now something else, a black hole that doesn't do anything anymore, or something of that sort. There are other possibilities. There are people who are willing to suggest that their constant of gravitation is changing or something, and these represent phenomena early, and later on we don't. So far, those kind of particular theories with the change in the constant gravitation have not proved to fit the data, as well as Einstein's general theory of relativity. So until somebody comes up with one that does a better job, that sort of thing seems to be somewhat out. One more then. I would say this, however. A great deal of what you're talking about is another phenomenon, and that is every time you look in areas that you've never been able to observe before, you find strange things that you didn't expect before. Okay? In fact, there seems to be more going on in the center of our galaxy than we thought was, and we're not quite sure what it is yet, but it's beginning to look like a very big black hole in the center of our galaxy. but we've never been able to observe there before, and still can't optically, because of the obscuring material, but we're beginning to be able to observe there with X-ray and other wavelength detectors. When we begin to look at smaller and smaller size fields very close to us, we see stranger and stranger things. And two things are happening. We're looking at areas we've never looked at before, and there's a tendency to think that areas you've looked at before aren't interested. There's no need to look into them. I think that's something of man's own security, a desire to have things under control and understood. And if he begins to look at more and more of the universe, he finds they're less under control and less understood than he thought they were. That is, less under his control. And the other thing is we're moving away from the things that we're used to and into the things we're not used to. But you still may be right. There's no way to say observationally that a theory has to be right when there's lots of things you haven't observed. What I would basically be arguing here is that the alternative seems to be less able to fit the material than the particular suggestion I made. Yes, sir.
Fred Boyle examined that pretty persuasively, or I do pretty persuasively, that instead of the universe expanding, we are shrinking.
The amount of physical laws one has to tamper with to produce that solution to me suggests that the burden of proof is upon Fred Boyle, not upon us who perhaps naively at least feel that there's a reason to believe that most of what we consider constants are at least reasonably constant. So, in other words, he's got to have some size scale phenomena going very drastically there.
If we have nothing outside of the universe that's consistent, so we have nothing to compare it with.
Well, I admit that. But you have plenty of things inside, and you've got to presume that they're all shrinking at the same rate for some unknown reason. Okay? But they... Unknown reason. Unnatural. Yes. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask a question about a biblical interpretation. Before I went, I'd like to make a comment that I read a while ago that some of the observations that we've been making on our own design, some of these space vehicles flying by there, they come up with a lot more questions before they thought they had everything figured out exactly how the sun is producing energy, but now they've got a lot more questions right here at home in our own solar system.
Yeah, no question about that.
The question I've got is the interpretation of Genesis, what seems like the stars are made on about the fourth day, and you've already got the earth made, and then the stars come after the earth. How do you deal with that?
My way of dealing with that is developed in the book Genesis 1, The Origin of the Earth. I'll give you a quick hint. So, hate to kill sale quote, you know. Basically, the suggestion there is that it is the sun, moon, and stars are made to appear on the fourth day to mark off the signs and function as signs and mark off the seasons and days and years, and that this is done by God clearing the atmosphere, which had been previously rather thickly clouded. There are some hints of that in Job, and that basically the beginning of the sun to actually ignite is at the point when there be light, and the presumably stars comparable phenomena there. But that basically is seeing that the creation account is written as it would be seen by an observer watching it on Earth, that God is giving us a pictorial way of seeing it as though we would stand there and watch what was happening from the Earth surface view once the Earth gets a surface to view it from. Well, that's developed in more detail in my book, but that's a quick sketch of the matter. Yes, sir?
It seems to me that a lot of the desires are rather fundamental physics law, says that a straight line is a physical point. And I'm thinking of the cosmological principle that you refer to on page 10, that the universe looks the same in all places and in all directions. If I understand that correctly, that was postulated in the face of the evidence that says that the universe is non-homogeneous and that it does thin out as it gets away from us. The principle then comes that really it looks that way to us and looks that way everywhere. When Einstein comes along with the curved space and puts a mathematical example to prove on it, but when you back it all down, it seems to me it starts out with a violation of the observation in the first place, and that Einstein simply put a mathematical example to prove on it, and now we can believe it even though it violates all our physical thoughts. And light going off in one direction, straight line, and just infinity comes back and puts me in the back of the head. That's my way off, but...
about your first part, I'm not quite so sure where you're headed for. I'm not sure it's obvious that things are necessarily thinning down the further and further away you look. I don't think that's an observation. Now, one could argue that if you started with Olber's paradox and pressed that and ignored other observations, one might go in that direction. But as we suggested, Olber's paradox can be solved in quite a large number of different ways. And so exactly how to solve that's not clear. Now, probably there's something to the problem, something to the cosmological principle that has a little bit of this tendency of scientists to extrapolate things to be normal beyond where they can observe them. But we do have to say, on the other hand, that, say, in the observation of quasars, you certainly don't have them thinning out as you look further and further out. If anything, you have them doing the opposite. So you're getting more of them as you look further and further out. So the question is, do we have a universe that appears to be clumped in one area and empty in another area, and it looks like the clumpiness goes down as the size scale gets larger? But then you begin, as the size scales get larger, to get into questions of age effects. If the universe has a history and you're looking at a substantial fraction of history, then you may be able to get some, then you may get some total changes over the whole history that are complicating things. I think it's fair to say that cosmology is faced with a difficulty of trying to unravel two or three different types of effects that get mixed together. For instance, distance effects and time effects naturally get mixed together because we can't sit around billions of years and see what happens. You're looking out a long distance, and those things out there happening a long time ago, and these in less and less. But these are also closer and closer and closer, and then further and further and further. So your time and your distance phenomena get tangled, and cosmologies usually attempt to untangle them in some way, and then to ask whether this still fits the data. So there's that difficulty, yes, no question about it. And I think you coined a little bit of that in dealing with the whole matter of the cosmological principle and uniformity of the space. Yes, sir?
That's wild. The point of this debate is how we are viewed the Big Bang is no problem.
Yes.
On day 13, by having creation of the Big Bang, you suggest that you tell that God
Not if you think of the Big Bang, it's around if he picked it up and used it. But God put on the Big Bang as the first step of his creation activity, yes.
On page 11, the person about envisioning the Big Bang as a creation event.
Yes.
When I think of an explosion of the Big Bang, there was something there that exploded.
Okay.
Now, then God created something before he caused the Big Bang? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. For instance, if you turn off a TV set, the picture goes down to a little point and that disappears. Turn that around in time. Here's a little point that appears and then comes up to a picture, okay? Well, was the point there before? No. It comes onto the screen, so to speak. So you might say God put matter energy into the universe, or created a matter energy universe complex which began to expand at that point. But he created it in an expanding state in that case. Okay. So I would put the ex nihilo there. Now certainly there was something before that. There was God before that. Okay. Not to mention whatever else he might have created in some other creation, as I would think of in regard to angels and such.
You have employed an analogy as do, by understanding many astronomical students, the analogy between sound transmission
and light.
And light transmission,
right.
So called red shift.
Right.
That, as I see it, causes me to put some question on the use of the word measurement.
I would say that to discuss anything that is not first-hand experience for hundreds of years, you're dependent upon analogy. Think about that. In fact, for many things that are first-hand experience for the whole human history, we have to use analogy. Most of our time words are distance words. A long time, a short time. Back in time, forward in time, yeah. So,
well,
well, now that's a tricky question. I suppose if, yeah, no, if you mean have we stretched a ruler out, stood at one end and looked at the numbers on the other end or something? I don't know. I should hope he doesn't think that. Well, I can't, yeah, that's something that's hard to... Well, their time with estimates can cover something for which are worthless versus something that really has some decent evidence for it, and then go all the way up to a direct sort of thing. So, how's that? There are certainly things I've talked about here that are estimates, and there are other things I think should be clear, should be fairly called measurements. Okay. Well, we'll see. Home promise these things. Yes, sir. Yes. The Mossbauer effect, a measurement that can be done in a laboratory, allows you to measure redshifts of light inside a device a few feet long. Yes, you can do things like that. So don't ask me for the details of it. I'm not that kind of a physicist. But it has to do with the motion of atoms and their absorbing energy at different rates when they're moving one way than the other. Yes.
I've got an even more direct one.
Yes.
I worked on an instrument, a laser beam, to measure the velocity of a gas by bouncing off of particles in the gas.
Mm-hmm.
And the laser beam, you know, you can measure the redshift down to a very fine.
Very fine.
And it's a beautiful instrument.
Yes, yes. Good, good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, there are a number of measurements of that sort. Obviously, you can't measure what light is doing way out there somewhere as though it's in your laboratory because it's not in your laboratory. Thank you very much for your attention.